So as we're settling back in, always noticing what great social energy is around a kitchen, right? Come on back. There, okay. So we are 6 days into 2015, and every single year it feels like I'm reminded of how cyclical our experience is in this realm as human beings. There was a long time ago a soap opera called The Days of Our Lives. I don't know if you remembered it, but there was like a preamble to the program which said, you know, tick tock like a clock that never stops. The days of our lives keep on coming. And the compression of experience into years and months and weeks and days and hours and minutes and moments and seconds is actually a very limiting kind of thing, although it makes human intercourse more feasible, that's for sure. More complex, more diverse. We keep our appointments, we're good little kids, we stay on time, we show up. But when the year comes around, it feels like we want a new beginning. We want to start on a completely different pad of paper. And so the new year is often depicted as a baby. It's a rebirth. And it gives us an opportunity to begin again. And what we want to do when we begin again is we want to make resolutions. We want to resolve to become better, more virtuous, whatever the virtues are that we want to cultivate. We want somehow to determine that this is a year that we're going to whatever, fill in the blank. And around the sixth day and then the sixth week, we begin to feel a little shaky. And by the sixth month, we've completely forgotten what our resolutions were until the next year comes around and we pick them up again. And it occurred to me that here we are, practitioners of mindfulness, dedicated to making profound change, uprooting lots of habits that we have accumulated over our life, and digging roots into new soil, and maybe flowering in a different way this year. But somehow or other, there's this French expression, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more they stay the same. That's one of the questions that I have most often in relation to practice. If this is so profound and we are committed to change, then why does it feel like fundamental elements of who we are and how we behave don't change? Especially since change is the order of the day. The first Buddhist principle is that everything is in the process of shifting and changing, and nothing is permanent. And yet we look inside ourselves and our behavior, and we can't help but notice that there's certain qualities, characteristics, and behaviors that feel like they're permanent. and we will never be liberated from the limitations of them. So today I thought maybe I will give you the very specific, almost technical analysis of how change happens to us as human beings, the fundamentals of change in correlation with the Buddhist theory of how we operate. In Buddhism, everything that arises, everything that exists, is identified as having been caused. Everything is a cause-effect situation. This breath that I'm breathing right now is the effect of the cause of needing some oxygen a moment ago. Every little detail of our experience is the effect of zillions of causes. And it operates that way inside of our brain. Every thought, every behavior that we are trying to uproot, as well as the ones that we celebrate, are caused again and again and again and have become deeply habituated. And we like to wake up every morning and think we're renewed, we're going to be different, this is going to be a new day. Things are going to be in a variation mode. But somehow or other, we sink into the same things. We go to the same place for coffee. We see the same people. We have similar conversations. And our day just unfolds rotely, habituated. So this habituated pattern of ours, like the time system that we have incorporated into our day-to-day lives, makes things very efficient, very economical, very streamlined, but it gives us a sense of deadness. It takes away our feeling of being immediate and excited and enthusiastic and alive. So how do these micro habits invade our experience so deeply and condition us so powerfully, so that in spite of our resolutions and in spite of our intentions, fundamentally we don't seem to change? It's an operating system in our brain. I know that we're mindful of both the body and the mind, as well as the heart, in this practice. But this evening, I would like to turn our attention to our mental formations, what we call thoughts, and the way that they affect us. Every thought that we have is the effect of having been caused by energy moving from one little neuron to another neuron in the brain. And the more that energy moves between neurons, what we call a synaptic bridge, the deeper the causation is conditioned. It's like energetic water running down a hillside, creating a bed, creating a stream bed, so that when water arises or when it comes from the sky, it finds that stream bed and flows down the same pattern down the hill. Our energy finds those synaptic repetitions and reiterates them again and again and again. A lot of this happens, of course, underneath our conscious awareness. And one of the great things about mindfulness is that we stretch experience out so powerfully that we can be on top of more microdynamics. We can see smaller and smaller and smaller bits of what it is that our subjective experience is made up of, from breath to breath, from moment to moment. So when we say we want to create a resolution to change, what we're really saying is we want the intention to practice attention so powerfully that we can watch a thought begin and we can recognize the path that it's going to take and realize we've had this thought a zillion times before. And every time that we arrive at the end of that thought process, we have not arrived at a solution. So we start from scratch. And that's the way that we trap ourselves in processes that are not effective at liberating ourselves from habituated, subjective experience. Every time that we track a thought beginning and let it go, we are cutting that deepening synaptic habit. We are literally stopping and recoding, and we're creating the positive habit of letting go of our obsessive thinking. The more that we do it, the more that our mind is inclined to say, ah, there you go again. And it just stops and dissolves. And we can retrace the way that we incorporate our experience, both our visceral experience, what's going on in our bodies, and the experience that enters from our five senses and the mind. So if we can intentionally pay attention to our thought formations, recognizing them and not allowing them to persist in deepening that synaptic bed, we will encourage ourselves to have fresh ideas, fresh sensations, a freshness of being present in the moment, and even enjoy an occasional, what we call, quiet mind, where no thoughts arise at all, because the mind is being deconditioned to not think so much, to not be so obsessive, to not be so activated all the time. This is really the refreshment that we want when we say we would like a rebirth, we would like a renewal. It's to be able to freshen the thought patterns and the sensations that are caused by the thought patterns and vice versa. Everything mutually affecting itself, engaging in creating this moment-to-moment experience we call being alive as ourselves. So if we can loosen our reverence for our thinking, understanding that thinking has a useful purpose, but we have come to a place where hardly any of our thinking is actually helpful. It's just the reiteration of things that we have said is our own personal Bible, and it's not true. Most of our thoughts are not true. They're not an adequate description of reality that can help us get liberated, wake up, be reborn, refreshed, and fully present in the moment. Which I think is what we are here to experience. So if we can stop worshiping our thoughts, and in fact notice them when they arise and not follow them to completion, we are reconditioning the causes. And in that way, we can inspire the causes of liberation. Now, most of the time, if we watch our thoughts, we notice that they fall into general categories. Jack Kornfield calls them the top 10 thoughts. I have the top three, and see if my thought patterns are like your thought patterns. They fall into large arenas. The first one is being self-critical. one of the struggles with practice is that we are silent and still and have absolutely no distractions from what our experience is, just being, not doing, just being. Why is it so difficult? Why is it such a challenge to be still and to be quiet with ourselves? Because for the most part, we're not at ease with ourselves. We don't like the way we look. We don't like the way we think. We might not like what we've achieved. We've got dozens and dozens and dozens of criticisms about who we are. So many of those are underneath our conscious awareness, but they seem to arise and bonk us when we're practicing meditation or when we're with ourselves. Discomfort just naturally arises. We're restless. We want to be distracted. We want to turn on the TV or the computer or text someone. All of this is an indication that we are not comfortable just being whoever we are at any given moment, like at this very moment. So, aversion within ourselves, theme number one. Theme number two, not enoughness. Not enough money, not enough time, not enough love. Very, very often our thoughts are entwined with the issue of not enoughness, which brings up fear, contraction, affects the way that we explore and see our lives and the world and the people around us and all the beings that surround us moment to moment, day after day. When really we live with such abundance. For me this year, I realized as I was practicing that when I take a deep breath, there's abundant air for me to breathe in so that I don't have to hold on to it. I don't have to be fearful about breathing it out because I know that when I breathe in again, there'll be more air for me to breathe in. And it's become a very important messenger for me of feeling abundance. Everything that I need is available. One way or another, my needs will be and are taken care of. And I think maybe it's a symptom of how indulged we are that we spend so much time fearful of not having enough. And the third general theme is worry, right? I like to say the mind is a worry-seeking missile. No sooner have we resolved some issue and feel comfortable and integrated, then something else arises. The mind is always dusting and doing housekeeping about what to worry about next. I, yesterday after 5 o'clock, called the Marin County Courthouse and discovered that I didn't have to show up for jury duty this morning at 9 a.m. The relief was so palpable in me that I realized for 4 days it had been oppressing me through all the holidays and the parties and everything. And I was so relieved, and then not 15 minutes later, I realized that whole relief had gone away, and I was already worried about something else happening that was possible just 10 days from today. So the mind feels that the job of the mind is to worry. God forbid it should be just quiet and on a hammock stretched out for too long. Something dangerous will happen to us. We're in trouble. So, self-criticism, not enoughness, and worrying. Those are the places that my mind really obsesses in, those nasty pools. So I wonder if you in this room know yourselves and have watched your mental formations enough to be able to categorize where does your mind go when it gets active? What kind of ruts does it fall into? And how many of those thoughts are so familiar that they're tiresome? They're exhausting. They make us tired when we've hardly done anything at all but raced around in our heads like a little gerbil. So my message tonight is the fundamental practice of mindfulness is to notice thoughts arise, not give them the credence of following them to their conclusions, but just saying, oh, I know you, I know your thought, I know, I'm familiar with your where you're going to go, I'm just going to drop you. And in that way, we actually have mastery over how our energy distributes in our brain, to the point where we can actually calm down the whole limbic part of the brain that is constantly giving us messages of anxiety. Constantly. Calming down the thoughts. Not believing in them, not having this religious adulation for our thoughts. Clearing the channels, cleaning up the desktop, and conserving energy that way. Our obsessive thinking actually drains us of our vital energy. It's not an efficient way to use this state that we call being alive and the energy foundation of it. And when we preserve our energy, everything good begins to happen. In Buddhism, it's the seven paramitas just naturally arise. We have joy. We have equanimity. We have insight. We have energy. We have compassion, wisdom, and all the fruits of having conserved our vital being. Because our natural birthright is to be happy, energetic, compassionate, have equanimity, and be fully alive with each moment. Just this breath. Just this moment. The gift of being fully present. And the sweetness of it is available when we have our energy available to us and don't squander it in repetitions of thoughts. So I'm talking about obsessiveness, which I think we all have very familiar experience of. Just becoming awake, whether we're sitting in formal practice or just moving through our day-to-day experience, the reminder to say, wow, am I talking to myself? What am I saying to myself? Where is my mind going right now? The moment that the mind knows it's being watched, Joseph Goldstein said this, the moment that the mind notices that it is being watched, it gets embarrassed and stops. Because it knows it doesn't have that much going for it in terms of being helpful to us when it's on obsessive tracks. So just the intention to pay attention and allowing it to arise like a bubble, you know, like a little champagne bubble arising to the surface of our conscious awareness, giving us the induction that we give ourselves permission to do this, whether we're in formal practice or just doing whatever it is we do from day to day attending to thoughts so that they actually stop. Like they are at this very moment. It feels like our mind, our collective mind, finds it easy to stop and just rest in awareness. There's nothing feeble about awareness. All the things that we have learned are operating. We don't have to pay attention to them with our conscious mind to be effective, to be intelligent, to do the right thing. These things can happen naturally. We don't have to hover over ourselves. The more we practice radical self-acceptance, the more we realize we're doing okay. We don't have to rehearse about who we're going to be in a certain situation or with a certain person. We don't have to edit who we were at a meeting or in a phone call. We can just trust that we were the best that we were at that moment, and we can let it drop. The more we practice radical acceptance, the more comfortable we're going to be with just resting in awareness, being happy to just be. Nothing else is required of us. We're fine the way we are. We have everything that we need, and our mind doesn't have to worry. That's the bliss that is promised in this practice. So if we can exert ourselves to intentionally pay attention, that's all that's asked, that's all that's required, you will arrive at equanimity and joy and wisdom, insight, and a young, youthful attitude of somebody who is not burdened by infinite causes that keep roiling around in our mind-body process. We can cut that thread, we can cut that loop every time that we surface into awareness, waking up into awareness. So we have the capacity to intend what the causes are that condition our next moments. And even though the sirens are blaring, there's nothing of emergency about us and what we are exploring and doing. At this very moment, everything is perfectly fine. In a moment like this, causes and conditions the next moment to be perfectly fine. And on from moment to moment. There's nothing wrong with feeling okay. It's safe. It reminds me of a story that Ram Dass told me, or us, once. He was in India with the first group of Western people that went to India for my generation, with a guru, and he was in love with the experience of being with this guru, and he stayed for many years, and the guru finally said, you know what, you need to leave and go out and explore more experiences, more teachers, more practices, go. So Ram Dass wanted to do everything that his beloved teacher suggested to him, so he left and he wandered through India. And a couple of years later, he showed up back at the same ashram in front of this old teacher. And the teacher said, "What are you doing back here?" And he said, "I have just one last question." And the teacher said, "Okay, shoot." And Ram Dass said, "What about death?" Because he didn't have anything else to worry about, but death was still something that he obsessed about. And the teacher looked at him and he said, "Oh, death, it's perfectly safe." So I remind myself, you know, oh, the next moment, it's perfectly safe. Oh, the next 24 hours, perfectly safe. Oh, my next meetings, my next calls, my next responsibilities, perfectly safe, because all I need to do is intentionally pay attention. And I trust in that profoundly and deeply, that the best that can happen arises from the intention to pay attention. And I'm as good as I can possibly be if I have that going for me. So I recommend it. It's not an act of faith, because life reflects back. Oh, I get feedback. Oh, it is okay. I did do all right. I didn't worry about the preparation. I didn't sweat through some kind of a, you know, meeting that I had to go to. And it was all perfectly fine. Waking up in the morning is perfectly safe. Brushing our teeth, drinking coffee, eating whatever. Life and death equally are perfectly safe. We have everything that we need. We are everything that is required. We are complete. There's a perfection to who we are at this very moment. Everything about us is perfectly fine. And this moment conditions the next. Let's see how much well-being we can tolerate before we make trouble for ourselves. So if you have any questions about the practice, about what we've talked about tonight, or any comments that you'd like to make, this is your time to do it. Please feel free. Yes, it's true. It's true. So knowing that it's something that is impersonal, actually helps us liberate ourselves from the truth of it, right? I mean, we're not living a dangerous life right now. It's a reptilian part of our brain. It's the earliest part of the brainstem that was developed. And it speaks of a very, very prehistoric time. I mean, it's useful if we're actually in a war zone, or if we confront somebody who threatens us. But for the most part, it's operating, it's been caused over millennia, right? So it's very deeply, deeply rooted. And that's why the intention needs to be sharp and renewed. Because we're not just doing it for ourselves, we're doing it for the whole species. We're doing it for the whole world. We're trying to make that change. It's an impersonal project to be able to finally overcome this deeply rooted survival anxiety that has very little relevance for what our day-to-day experience is about. Yeah. Yeah. So if we understand that, then we can actually understand compassion for ourselves, because we are at the mercy of that. And understanding and having compassion for ourselves means we want to liberate ourselves from that, because it's not an ultimate truth, but we are so conditioned and driven by it. It's kind of humiliating, you know, to, you know, have shoulders up and to be defensive and to be contracted, and we're living an indulged and luxurious and wonderful life. I mean, it's like, it doesn't make sense. It's incongruent. Yeah. I think that we long to struggle. I think that we've made struggling a measure of our goodness, of our worthiness. You know, if we don't have something to overcome, how do we know that we're good, that we're strong, that we're virtuous, and that we've done it? You know, how can we get satisfaction without overcoming struggles? And we've really made our lives more difficult than they need to be because of this negative drama. We're addicted to it. The drama of suffering, but not the suffering, not dukkha suffering, but the suffering of always feeling that there's going to be something that's coming against us. So one of the things that I've resolved for myself this year was dropping the sense that there would always be barriers. Always having like a negative slant. God forbid that I should be disappointed. People like to think negatively as a way of avoiding disappointment, I've realized in my practice. Wow. You know, in my therapy practice, you know, I like to keep people in a positive vein, but they want to look at the worst of it because, God forbid, the worst should happen and they haven't prepared for it. So there is a negative slant, and we can find it all across the board if we look at our moment-to-moment experience. And if we say, is that true? Am I really in danger? Is that really a threat? Do I really need to overcome this? Usually the answer is no. It's a paper tiger. It's a rope that looks like a snake. We can let go and relax and begin to have a sense of the let go, relaxed way of being is dynamic, is interesting, it isn't boring. We can achieve things in it, we can love through it, we can feel all kinds of feelings in it. We can actually learn to create the causes of easeful being, to counteract the infinite causes that we have for being stressed. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Have you noticed the negative drama?
Yeah.
How do you do that with something other than negative drama?
Well, you know, don't be critical of yourself. Don't put yourself down. Noticing it is in and of itself the solution. When awareness touches something, it has a tendency to dissolve. So that's what Joseph was talking about. When the mind knows that it's being watched, it stops. So when we catch ourselves in negative drama, the very act of being aware of it dissolves it at that moment. It'll come back because it's deeply habituated. But the more times it comes back and we dissolve it, we are creating a positive habit. So we need to kind of, you know, create positive habits to undermine so many of the negative habits that are coursing and commanding our moment-to-moment experience. Just being awake, that moment of being awake, dissolves the drama. And it's important to not be self-critical, to not say, oh my God, here I go again, you know. Just understand that we have conditioned, we're using our minds in ways that are not most effective, efficient, compassionate, practical. And, you know, culture has a tendency to invoke that in us because it makes us vulnerable to wanting to shop, wanting to be distracted by the media, and to be driven. And I'm not sure that I really profoundly don't believe that that is the most effective way of us as a species to live life enjoyably and survive well. I don't think that we need stress to survive well. But we've been sold a bill of goods, a lot of bills of goods. So finding ourselves in a state that creates contraction, just noticing that and letting go. Conditions a new cause and a new effect in that very moment. That we've got to add up the numbers, you know? Do it often enough. But it is a self-revealing process because there is a liberation that you feel in that moment. And like everything in this practice, you want experience to inform you about the effectiveness of what you're doing. So if you feel lighter, if you feel better, that's the A+. So that's what I want for all of us tonight and this week and this year and forever, to liberate ourselves from the conditions that make us contracted, unhappy, feel less than, feel like we have to struggle to make anything happen, and that don't give us that expanded, wonderful, leisurely experience of just being, because being embodied is a temporary state. And every single moment that we are in this experience is an extraordinary moment. It's a blessing. So, like a bell ringing clearly, every single moment is a bell stroke. Is awakening moment. And if we cultivate that awareness, it's possible that that awareness is not, it's conditioned by the body, but it is not defined by the body. Very, very likely, awareness is who we are. Awareness is who we were before we were embodied. Awareness is who we are being embodied. And awareness very well may be who we are after being embodied. So cultivate that awareness. Become familiar with it. Be happy in it. All right. Thank you very much. Howie will be back. Is there another question? Did I see a hand? It's yes? Yeah. You're talking about a large behavior. I'm talking about small little increments. We have to start with small little increments. If we go for a big behavior, we'll fail. But there's all kinds of infinite causes that create behaviors that are damaging to ourselves. There's no way that behaviors that damage us naturally arise. So every little bit of wakefulness actually undercuts large habits that are destructive to us. So don't make it a big, big, big challenge to yourself. Just make it just break it down into smaller and smaller and smaller components of attention. So every mountain is climbed step by step, breath by breath. Okay, thank you.